Hello and welcome to episode 6, a post-game SideQuest Patreon podcast all about hot takes on cold games. I'm Melissa. I'm SideQuest editor-in-chief. Boy, I'm just struggling with words this morning. And I use she, her pronouns.
I'm Nassim. I'm SideQuest's managing editor, and I use them pronouns. Welcome.
I'm Zora. I'm SideQuest assistant editor and copy ogre, and I use they, them pronouns.
As you, if you are up to date on our podcast, you might know that it's gotten a little bit toasty in here because we actually talked about a game released not only within like the last 5 years, but like the last like, I mean, time is an illusion, but at least the last year. I don't remember when the fuck Hades came out. But it was,
well, it depends who you ask. It could have been 2018 and it could have been 2020, but it was eligible for 2020 awards. Mm.
It was in like alpha or whatever for a long time, right?
Yeah, it was in open access or early access for a couple years, which was like a foundational part of the dev cycle for that game specifically. Yeah.
Interesting. So that was entirely too hot for us. In a variety of ways. So this episode, we are taking the polar plunge, and we're doing a podcast entry into one of our favorite columns on SideQuest, which is My First Game, where we talk about our first game, if you hadn't. with some flexibility, because I got very creative in my answer.
What does first really mean in your heart? Don't look at the dictionary. Just feel it in your soul.
let's begin with our intro to playing. I mean, we usually begin with an intro, but let's talk about how... I'm so sorry if you can hear Penny in the background. Go to sleep or something.
I cannot, but hello,
yeah,
Penny.
Yeah, I can't either.
Hello, sweet friend.
Cats sleep fucking 18 hours a day, and the 6 hours a day they aren't sleeping are the hours when I am on a video call, in a meeting, or podcasting. So let's talk about how we started playing games, like where we were in our lives at the time that games entered the sphere. Zora, tell me.
Yeah, so when games entered my life, I was not forming memories. I legitimately don't remember a time in my life before video games were just, like, part of my world. Much like Ariel wants to be. I'm so sorry. So my dad got a PS1 when I was no more than 4. I feel like I remember him getting it because I feel like I remember my mom being upset about it. But before that, my best friend, who I spent a ton of time with, had a PlayStation 1 and an N64. And then my downstairs neighbors, who I spent like the rest of my time with, had a PlayStation 1, upon which we played a Power Rangers game that I have very fond memories of, but I'm pretty sure was god awful. So I'm not.
I think that's the childhood experience, is like all of these games so good. And then you're like, Were they?
Yeah, so I'm a gamer for life, and we're going to ignore the fact that I play maybe 10 games a year and didn't play any games for about 7 years between college and 2018. So,
no judgment.
None at all. You get to decide what gamer means to you, Zora.
It means a decidedly loose approach to definitional meanings.
Excellent.
You're up, Nassim.
Okay. So I started playing as a kid. The thing that I remember kicking off my gaming was getting a Game Boy Color and Pokemon Blue for my 8th birthday.
Hell yeah.
I don't know if that actually was... I don't have a lot of childhood memories. They all kind of blur together. I distinctly remember that being a thing, though, and that was a big neon light in my life. And I played quite a few PC games, like... franchise PC games, like the Harry Potter Sorcerer's Stone game. I love.
Yes.
I remember trying to fight Voldemort on Christmas, and so I was singing Voldemort Got Run Over by a Reindeer. And it was very hard. I was very frustrated. And I was also obsessed with this game called Lords of Magic, which I think about zero people have heard of, which I loved. But I don't know if that came before or after Pokemon. And I know I got the like PS1 when it became slightly slimmer. I remember getting that and getting like 5 copies of Spyro because my brother would break it every time he'd finish it. And yeah, it was this thing that he would do that for DVDs and games, but when he was like, done with the game, he'd snap the CD in half. We spent a lot of money on Spyros. Those were not cheap. And the only year that we really did Christmas with like, we had a tree that was maybe a foot tall because we're Muslim. My parents got us a PS2. So I, you know, games were kind of in my life in the background for a while. And then I think there were some years where I didn't really play because I was too cool or whatever. I rediscovered Pokemon in high school when my friend was like, Pokemon is cool. And I was like, oh yeah, I love Pokemon. That was my thing as a child. And then, yeah, like started becoming more serious with gaming, I guess, in college. But I've kind of always played games in the background, even when I thought I was too cool for it. So
I don't know if you just heard that right now, but I spilled water all over my face.
Oh no.
We're fine. It's fine.
Refreshing.
I just had a moment. We're good. We can continue.
Anyway, Missy, tell us about your games.
Sure. So technically, I've been playing games since I was a kid, but this comes with a rather large caveat. I think that my family growing up had a NES before I was born. Like, I don't remember not having this NES, which we had, I think, 3 games for. We had the Duck Hunt Super Mario combo. I already wrote about Duck Hunt, so we're not going back into Duck Hunt. And I didn't like Super Mario, so.
Oh, no.
Yeah, I hope you're ready.
Also had the Duck Hunt Super Mario combo.
I think it came with the NES. Like, I think when the NES launched in the US, I think it came with that.
Maybe my early memories are an NES and not the Nintendo 64. Hold on, I gotta Google some shit.
So I hope you're ready for like every whatever scrap of gamer credibility I have is about to go out the window in this episode, because I fucking hate, I don't like any Mario games. And also we'll talk about my quote unquote first game later. I later got an SNES for my birthday and I played like a ton of Gonky Donk. What the fuck is wrong with my mouth today? I played a lot of Donkey Kong Country, specifically 1 and 3. And then also I had some Disney movie tie-ins, which I don't know if you guys ever played the Lion King movie tie-in, but it is the hardest goddamn game.
I've heard this.
On Earth. After that, I didn't really have reliable access to games because I was super poor. So I had friends that had, you know, Sega Genesis, played a lot of Toe Jam and Earl. My dad had a PC where I would watch him play games. I had a friend with a PlayStation 1 where I could occasionally play games there. But my access was always limited to what other people had. So I didn't really build my own taste in video games until I was a teenager. Mm-hmm. And my friends very kindly pulled together their money and bought me a PlayStation 2. Instead, I did in the meantime... It was really, really sweet, especially because I had fucking terrible friends.
Oh my god.
It's
got them.
I did. I hope they're listening. Instead of playing games, what I did was I really liked games and I was like really into them, but I couldn't play them. So I bought like Electronic Gaming Monthly and PlayStation Magazine and Nintendo Power at the grocery store, and I would read them.
Oh my god, Missy.
So I have these like really intense memories associated with, in particular, the Ocarina of Time, a game I've never played all the way through, and the first Silent Hill. I had nightmares from reading the walkthrough of the first Silent Hill.
This rules.
And this was all primarily because it's a lot easier to afford a gaming magazine once a month than it is to afford even a single video game.
Yeah.
Later on down the line for a birthday, I got Game Boy Color, and I played a lot of Pokemon Yellow and a lot of Pokemon Crystal. Pokemon Silver and Pokemon Crystal.
Silver. Yes.
So good.
So good.
I played that like all the way through high school. I never put that down. I still have the Game Boy. I still have the cartridge. It's decorated with like these goofy ass stickers I got in high school. And those were the only games I had, again, because I was super bored. So games have always kind of been this like thing that I wanted to do, but I didn't have the money or the access, or my taste was always limited by what other people wanted. So I never really got to form my own taste.
Yeah.
So our next question is, you know, what was your first game? And what else, you know, we want to talk about coming off of that? Like, what is the relevancy of that first game to where we are, or whatever interesting tidbit we want to share? And I will go first.
This is where the gaming cred gets blown up.
Yes. I hope you're ready for this. So
the story,
as I said,
is excellent, and you should all be very excited.
So the real answer is probably Duck Hunt is actually my first game, but I wrote about that for the website already, so you can read that. The link will be in the show notes. The next answer is probably Donkey Kong Country, but like, I have nothing to say about Donkey Kong Country. I didn't really like it. I played it a lot because it was what I had, but I didn't really like it. I can say this is the most 90s kid thing ever. There's a song in Donkey Kong Country that sounds like the theme song to these toys that were like muscle sharks. And it was like the theme song went teeth, claws, muscles, and jaws. And that rhythm fit in perfectly with this song. And I think it was like the jungle theme in Donkey Kong. So I would sit there and sing teeth, claws, muscles, and jaws while playing Donkey Kong Country. there's a handful of other games too that would be like Diablo 2. My experience with Diablo 2 was pretty foundational, but like also I didn't know how to play it. I just ran around and hoped for the best. And Final Fantasy X was another big one, but not only have I already written about it, but eventually we're going to talk all about Final Fantasy X. And also I played like a fuck ton of The Sims, but I wrote about that too. So, you know, I've been writing for side quests for 6 fucking years. So
really mined that content out of your brain.
Yeah, truly. So like, we decided to do this episode and I've been sitting here fucking agonizing over what game I'm going to talk about. And it finally hit me that there's one really good answer to this question that I, A, haven't written about already, and B, ties into a fundamental gaming experience for me. But you're going to have to hold on, because first I have to tell a story. As if I haven't told enough already.
I like your stories, Missy.
Thank you. So I was still in elementary school. My mom would drop me off at a friend's house in the morning because she had to be to work early. So I would catch the bus from this friend's house, and they had a PlayStation. Again, I didn't have any say over what games they had, but they did have some good ones like Rampage. So I used to play this PlayStation in the morning, and they had this one game that was like, it was an off-roading game, off-road racing game, and it sucked. Like, it's a bad game. But I've looked up the name to it like 86 times, and it's like this super obscure one that nobody cares about because it just wasn't good. And I think it was like during the like glut of PS1 games.
Yep.
It was ugly. It was bad. It like wasn't super fun. And I think the only reason I played it was because it was the only racing game they had. They also had Gran Turismo, but like Gran Turismo, I can't remember what it's, is it? It's not arcade. Maybe it is arcade. It's the kind of game where it's like you're not supposed to turn around and go the wrong way down the track.
It's a very serious game for very serious people.
Yeah, I'm not about that life. Off-road racing naturally would let me go off-road and like just crash into other cars and stuff like that. So off-road racing, whatever the game was the one for me. And in this game, the whole track was like surrounded by this fence. Which off in the distance, it had some like vague shapes and stuff like that made it look like the game world went beyond just the confines of this fence. And I was like captivated with this game world. I think there was like a pyramid in one of the levels, and I was like, I need to see the pyramid. I need to. And one day, I guess I got bored and I just drove straight into the fence and I happened to hit it just right and I clipped through the fence. And so I drove around outside of the confines of this game world and like my mind was blown. I was like, oh my God, this is a real thing. Like it, this stuff is really here, but it's broken. I'm not supposed to be out here. This is so exciting. Like, it was probably the single most exciting gaming experience to me up until that point. And I have been chasing that high ever since. But this is not about the shitty racing game because like that's truly the best experience I ever had with it. I am going to talk about the game that finally recaptured that for me, which is Portal, which came out in 2007, the year I graduated high school. It is not my first game, but it's close enough. here comes the fake gamer girl. All of it. I started dating my husband in 2007, my now husband, and he had so many video games. I had never seen somebody with so many video games. And I would go to his house after work and we would just play video games and watch shitty movies.
Cute.
Just the amount of fucking games he had, mind boggling. And then he moved in with me and then I had all of the video games. But he mostly like at the time he mostly liked shooters. He played a lot of shooters and Skate, which kicks ass. And then he also really liked like Guitar Hero and Rock Band and stuff like that. So we got really into Rock Band 2. We would have our friends over and we'd all play Rock Band 2, which had some DLC. And one of the free DLC songs was the song Still Alive from the Portal soundtrack. I had not played Portal, but I did play a lot of Rock Band 2, and I really loved this fucking song, Still Alive. I was obsessed with it. I started listening to it all the time. Again, had not played Portal, had no context for the events of the song. I just really liked the song. And the only reason I decided I would play Portal was because of the song. I am truly the gamer girl of your nightmares.
My favorite fact.
It is entirely true. That's the only reason I decided to play Portal.
It's a good reason to decide to play Portal is the thing.
Yeah, and it's a good. Yeah. I know it got memed to death, right? I know. I'm aware. I know Portal is like the memeiest game, but like it is a good fucking game, and the jokes are fucking funny. And I'm sorry, your hearts have hardened. But it's good, actually.
Portal genuinely deserves its place in, like, game history. That said, it is a joke now.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. But it is a good song, and I was very into Jonathan Coulton at the time, and, you know.
Much like many of my friends, somebody who has, like, a very strained relationship with Jonathan Coulton now? Because a lot of folks I was never that into his music because I'm boring. But I have a lot of friends who like loved it and have listened to it recently and been like, ooh, we were different people in 2012.
it's very goofy in a way that I think I look back on it and it's like, it's a little embarrassing, but it's kind of just the way I feel about my younger self, which is like, you're a little bit embarrassing, but you're doing your best. And you know, I'm happy for you. I can't get down to Code Monkey these days, you know. I can't get down to Re Your Brains. I still think the I Fight Dragons cover of that one Jonathan Coulton song fucking slaps. Does it suck? Kind of, but it still kicks ass also. So
I would argue that Still Alive holds up.
Oh yeah, Still Alive is great. I love the whole Portal soundtrack. Portal 2's entire soundtrack is great. I routinely still get the opera song stuck in my head.
Oh my God.
This is who I am. If you're not familiar with Portal, somehow, it is a first-person puzzle game where you shoot portals that you can travel through, and you kind of have to escape from this science facility where the robot overseer Gladys has gone bonkers with power, and she's very snarky and she bullies you a lot. More importantly, nice. and this is She's not very nice. In Portal 2, she has an interesting backstory, though. I fucking love Portal so much. Anyway, midway through Portal 1, you can start to encounter these little secret passages that if you use your portals right, you can zip into. And they contain some like sort of backstory, side story stuff that is clues to the broader world that Portal takes place in, which I did not give one single shit about. But the fact that I could, it felt like, get out of the confines of what I was supposed to see and into what I wasn't supposed to see was very, very exciting for me. And I didn't discover all of these until like several times replaying the game. about two thirds of the way through the game, spoilers for this very old game, but GLaDOS is like sending you on a little trip to into the fire to kill you. And you're supposed to use your portals to escape from that platform and like into like the back hidden areas of Aperture Science. And that remaining, you know, one third of the game is about exploring all of this like shitty, unfinished, rusty back halls of what until this point has been a very slick, crisp, beautiful, white, sterile science facility. And the moment that happened, like I liked the game up until that point, but the moment that happened, it was legit like, it felt like they had tapped into the same excitement of finding that glitch in that shitty racing game over again. Even though it does it intentionally, it still like captured that feeling of being outside the bounds of where I was supposed to be. But it was so exciting. And the last third of the game is like built on this feeling of you're not doing what you're supposed to be doing, especially because the, you know, GLaDOS keeps yelling at you to stop doing that. But it was so exciting to me to feel like I had tapped into this ability to see something that I wasn't supposed to see anymore. And then I got more and more invested in finding all of the little secrets in this game. And so I started looking things up, which led me down this like deep rabbit hole, not only into like theories about Portal, which whatever, but it actually led me into like criticism of Portal, like talking about, I remember there was this kind of infamous article talking about the game as a feminist masterpiece where you shoot holes instead of phallic bullets. And also
interesting.
And also where GLaDOS is almost like a bound upside down version of the Venus de Milo. I don't remember what this criticism was saying, but the fact that somebody was making these arguments about this game was like, what? This is so interesting. And now look at me. That's what happened. It's all thanks to Portal and Rock Band 2 for including Jonathan Coulton Still Alive as a free bonus DLC. That's what I've got.
I one of the reasons that this kind of like looking into foundational text thing is so interesting to me is because you get glimpses into like convergences of interests for people.
Mm-hmm.
Like this stupid racing game like fundamentally informed what gaming could be for you. And my I don't know anything about the actual human beings who are the developers of Portal, but I would totally believe that something similar happened to them, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because why else would you be so fascinated with the halls behind the main areas of a game, right? Mm-hmm. So that there's that. So those that's like a convergence of experience. But also like you playing Portal after adolescence when you're like beginning to have power over your own life in a way that, you know, young adults do. And then latching on to all of the games crit stuff is wild.
it really was.
Yeah, go ahead.
Go ahead. Oh, Well, it is. It really was the first time I got to have any say over the kinds of games I was playing. Until that point, I had always been only exposed to the games that other people had. And at that point, like Portal led me into Half-Life, which I could not play. It was too Half-Life 2, too scary for me. I made it to Ravenholm and no further. It also led me to try Left 4 Dead, which was the first shooting game I was any good at and my husband was bad at. And that made me feel really good in my late teens, early 20s. And that led me to getting Steam, which led to like playing more indie games. It led me to watching Hey Ash, What You Play In, which is, if you're not familiar, an ancient web series from before the dawn of time, starring Ashley and Anthony Birch, where they make absurdist comedy videos about video games.
Right. Like, it's good, is what I'm saying. I don't know. I don't know. Have particularly strong academic thoughts about this idea, but like, and maybe you would have arrived where you arrived anyway, but seeing the path that you actually took is so cool. And I'm going to talk about this probably like from a different angle when I talk about my first game. But it fundamentally informs kind of everything you do from here on, which isn't meant to be some sort of like butterfly flapping its wings kind of shit. But criticism is built on like the combination of experience and, you know, extrapolation on that experience. And so all of these experiences you had with Portal, but also with that shitty racing game when you were like eight, are going to inform how you approach like wonder in games. And that's sick.
Yeah, it's, I can't, like, I wish that I could play Portal 1 again for the first time for that moment of excitement when I was encouraged to go outside the bounds of the game. There are other games now that kind of play with this too, like the Stanley Parable has a similar feature. And Stephanie wrote for our site an article, I think it's called Giving the Narrator, Flipping the Narrator the Bird or something about something like that, which is like about how much she enjoys games that encourage her to play against the grain. And yeah, that kind of thing is very exciting for me just because like it's hard. I can't think of another medium that would let you peek behind the curtain quite like that or capture mm-hmm. that feeling in the same way.
All right. Speaking of curtains and me being deeply fundamentally afraid, which was my experience of the tail end of Portal. And also this game that Nassim is about to talk about. Nassim, do you want to talk about your first game?
Yeah. So technically, I think my first ever game that I was exposed to was Prince of Persia. Because, boy, let me tell you, Persians do love seeing themselves in things. I know this very, very brief tangent, but if you've seen My Big Fat Greek Wedding and how the dad is like, oh, yes, everything was back to Greek, that was my dad with Persian things. So Prince of Persia, we had like this old Mac that sat in my dad's office. And I just remember seeing this like pixelated person running across a black screen. And I don't think I ever really played it, but that's like the first true first game. But the game that I really associate also with my dad, unsurprisingly, is Myst, so, which also scared the shit out of me. And I guess I forgot that it really did terrify me.
I did not enjoy it. I played it late at night with my friend while we were in high school and we did not know what was going on. We were so freaking scared.
It is such an opaque game. I mean, like, I only now kind of remember what's going on because I really got into the lore when I was like a teen. There was a book at the library and I was like, oh, this game my dad and I played. But honestly, in the game, you're like, I don't even know what's going on. But for those who don't know, Myst is, it came out in the mid-90s, I think, for the computer. And it's this game where it opens with you, who is called the stranger, like reading a book about like called Myst, and then when you get to the last page you're transported to this island, and it's this empty island that has like observatories and libraries, and you don't know what's going on because there's no other people there. And then you get transported to other worlds with books. Like you open a book and you get transported into it. And eventually you apparently pieced I say eventually you apparently because my dad and I never got this far. But apparently you piece together that like basically this is like a hub world where somebody has created the ability to go into books. And there are these two guys who's like these two brothers who are stuck in books who are like, you have to help us get out. Like our father disappeared. We blame the other brother. And that's like the drama of it. But my dad and I never got that far. I just remember us sitting, and I think he was doing most of the playing, and I was just like, wow, I'm obsessed with my dad. He's the smartest person I know, and I'm watching him play this game.
The dad plays a video game experience.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like, you know, it was a smart game. That's, you know, this my young self was like, oh, here's a smart game for smart people. And again, dad is the smartest person I know. I want to be smart, therefore this cool ass game. And, you know, this is the time I remember it being very new that we had a PC at home. This was like about the time where PCs were starting to take off to come to homes. And my dad was like somewhat involved in it because he saw like my brother who has classical autism, like trying to engage with the game. And he's like, okay, I need to like make a touch screen so that my son can engage with like whatever he's trying to do on the computer. So I just remember like being like a very computer literate family with like, wow, here are computers and all the things they can do. And then in schools, we were playing like the Jumpstart games, which I loved. Like Jumpstart third grade was my absolute shit. And I think it came after coming from this experience of sitting next to my dad playing this smart person game and being like, wow, look at like all these opportunities that games can do because they are for smart people as well. Or whatever, and you're not just like this little fish driving around looking for like wrenches and things, which I also loved that game. Like no shade on whatever game that was, but
when you're like just... six and you're the fish and you're succeeding at driving around, you're like, I'm the smartest person I know.
It's true. Yeah, I wonder if they still make those games. They were great. I had a ton of fun with them, but I think like Myst was always this bastion of like what a game could be, even though we didn't even, I don't even think we got that far in it. Like maybe we got to one other or two other hub worlds.
I've only played the 3DS port of Myst, which is like universally agreed to be utter and complete trash.
Oh, no.
But, and I did not make it very far because of the degree of trash that it is. But like even playing it, you know, fucking, it's 15, 6, I don't even know, years and years upon years after it came out, it still has that feeling. Like I look at the game world and I'm like, this is really cool. Like I can't play it because the game is badly designed. Not Myst itself, but the port. I cannot stress how bad the port is. But like it has that, it really kind of captures your imagination in a way. And like the idea of being able to travel into books and stuff like that would have like been so my shit as a kid if I had played it.
Yeah.
This it's is like all, very it's, exciting.
It's always fascinating for me to listen to people talk about Myst because my experience with that game, which was as a 14-year-old, maybe, on my friend's computer that was running like Windows XP in, how old was I? Wait, no, what year would it have been? In like 2008 or something, right? So like way after this game came out. But we were running an old game on an old computer and we were both 14 and it was like 11 p.m. and we were not supposed to be on the computer. And we did not understand what was going on. And it was more opaque than any game I'd ever played in my life. I was scared as shit because the game is, if the positive feeling that I have about that game is that it's very, very, very effective at like immersing you in the unknown.
Yeah, it's really creepy.
But when you're a 14-year-old who's going through some shit and has mostly played like Wind Waker.
Wow.
It is a distinctly frightening and unpleasant experience. We didn't make it far at all. We walked from one end of the island to the other end of the island, and we did that like two or three times, and then we were like, nah, I'm gonna go play Super Mario World.
Yeah,
like, I'm good.
It's a game, It's very atmospheric, and I think the music was also creepy. I don't remember
the music
so much
was
now,
super creepy.
Right, yeah, I have this distinct like feeling that the music was creepy. You don't know what's happening. There's nobody else on these like in these worlds, and so it's just
you're
like
totally alone. I was convinced that if we pushed the wrong button, we were gonna die horribly. Like, I don't know if that happens, but I was 100% convinced that like if we one, we couldn't figure out what to do to make anything do anything. We couldn't do it. And I was convinced that once we did, the thing that we made whatever we affected do was going to be to just kill us, like a Nancy Drew game.
Yeah. Oh, I totally could have talked about the fucking Nancy Drew games for this. Oh, my bad. Sorry. That was my podcast alarm. That was late. Oh, I totally could have talked about Nancy Drew games. And how much
they're great.
Oh my god, they were so good. Secrets Can Kill scared the shit out of me. That was the first one, I think.
Yeah, I also did not play Nancy Drew games.
Oh my god, they're so good. Anyway, that is something I should have thought of and did not. Mist explains why I loved Nancy Drew games so much, though.
I would believe that. Oh, that lineage makes sense to me.
Yeah.
Totally.
Holy shit. I loved Nance. Oh my god. Yeah, it totally does explain it.
I would like to propose that someday we all play Nancy Drew game. Like, we stream Nancy Drew games together.
Yes, that would be great.
Yes.
And I would like to bring in Maddie as well, because Maddie is our resident.
Maddie does love
Nancy Drew expert.
Nancy Drew. Maddie might be the only person who can solve the puzzles for us.
It's true.
I played Secrets Can Kill for many times. I think that was game 5 or 6. And I kept my notes that I took while I was doing it. And so when I replayed the game, like, years later in high school or whatever.
We can't replay a game.
Oh, no. I'm not saying that. Oh, I agree. I'm just saying that that's the only way I got through it in later years. But I was like, I'm so glad I spent this time doing this years ago.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of Googling the answer. I'm playing the Talos Principle with my friend Kat right now, and we both, like, without even asking each other, we were like, so we're gonna Google the location of all the stars, right? Like, we're not even gonna we're just gonna, if we find them on our own, good for us. If we don't, we're just gonna look it up.
Yeah, that's a good approach.
Anyway,
I think exactly what you said about my choice, Zora, is also, like, really, really interesting here, thinking about Nassim, you're starting off with Mist and Nancy Drew, and then just, like, knowing you as a writer and that kind of, like, it's and your investment in these, like, deep stories in games. I love it.
It all comes together.
I love this because you know what game I'm going to talk about?
Tell us, Zora.
Ape Escape. A game about an evil monkey man who's controlling all of the monkeys to take over the world.
I love it.
That's the game that formed who I am as a writer and a thinker.
Are you the evil ape, or are you the apes trying to escape?
Oh, I am definitely an ape trying to escape. I am definitely a mind-controlled ape just really trying to get back to its happy monkey life. As aren't we all, though?
It's true.
It's true.
So my first game, and I think this, it's because I can't remember a time before video games, I cannot be sure that this is the first video game that I ever experienced in any substantial way. Like, I can do later games. I can do like Pokemon Crystal was my first game that I owned, and Super Smash Bros. Melee was the first console game that I owned. And boy, did I play a lot of it. You want to talk about games that had an important effect or took an important place in your life? I played that game for 8 hours one day as we moved out of my mother's house.
Whoa.
Wow. Yeah. My dad set me up in a bedroom and was like, entertain yourself, my child. While I managed the moving. And I was like, okay. Oh, yeah. And then I played as Sheik for 8 hours.
Nice.
Thank you very
Amazing.
Much. I unlocked most of the characters that day.
That'll do it.
Yeah, I had a liter of Sprite. And I probably ate normal food also. My dad wouldn't just like abandon me without food. But I remember the Sprite and the video game because that was the first time that I had drank that much soda at once, and also the first time that I had played that much video game by myself at once.
That's a formative gamer experience.
It was so formative. On the floor in a bedroom too is also like the quintessential gamer experience. Yeah, it was a lot. Anyway, but the first game that I think that I like have memories of experiencing is Ape Escape for the PlayStation 1. I looked it up. The PlayStation 1 came out in 1994, which is the year I was born. And I was born late in the year, so the PlayStation 1 predates me.
Whereas, once again, it's only a 6-year difference, and yet I feel fucking ancient.
Every year, in college, we would host what we called the Defectors Party, which was a party for some people who had been in like the club that I was in. Lots of alum would come back for Carnegie Mellon's carnival. And during carnival, we would host the Defectors Party. And every year we would get a cake and we would write something funny on the cake. And my junior year, which would have been 2015, we wrote, "These kids are younger than Pikachu" on the cake to horrify every old person who came back to see him.
Oh my God. Incredible.
Wow. Anyway, so the PS4, the PS4, the PlayStation 1, PlayStation 1 predates me. And Ape Escape, I don't know if Ape Escape predates me, but it certainly predates me forming memories. And so I just, my dad had Ape Escape, and my best friend at the time, Matthew, had Ape Escape. And I watched both of them play Ape Escape a lot. And I also played Ape Escape, but I was very bad at it. So I mostly watched them, and there are parts of Ape Escape that to this day populate my dreams. Like, I don't have
dreams or nightmares.
Well, depends on the day.
Oh.
I don't have very interesting dreams.
As someone who has very vivid dreams, I'm impressed to hear that you
My dreams are really boring. When I have vivid dreams, they're very mundane, right? Like, once I had a dream about waking up and going and turning on my computer, and then I woke up from that dream and had another dream about getting up and turning on my computer, and then I woke up and it was dark and I stared at the wall and just contemplated my brain and why it would do this to me.
I used to have really vivid dreams, but now I have extremely mundane dreams, much like those.
Anyway, I mean, I'm into it. When I start having real, like, more exciting dreams, my sleep goes to shit, so it's fine.
Yeah, I don't recommend it.
But so I when I dream, and they're not the mundane, I woke up and I turned on my computer and I started to do some work type dreams. They not infrequently take place in environments like that I hazily half remember from Ape Escape. Like,
fascinating.
There was this pool image going around, and I'll see if I can find it and put it in the show notes. It was going around on Twitter. That's like a picture of a pool that's like a pathway to another pool. And everyone was like, "Whoa, I've been there in my dreams." And I'm like, "That's because it was a level in Ape Escape." It was a level in Ape Escape. There was a monkey in that pool, and that monkey was a little motherfucker.
I've never played Ape Escape, so I'm looking at images of it, trying to, this is horrifying, Zora. I'm afraid of your nightmares.
There's another level later on in the game where it's a evil theme park at night.
Oh my God.
Sometimes I dream about that theme park. There's a bit where you get on a roller coaster and you zoom on through and you might die on that roller coaster. And my father certainly did many times, not in my dreams, in the video game. Yes.
I just put a GIF in our Slack and it's so scary.
It certainly is.
My computer is refusing to let Slack load, so I'm going to trust that it's horrifying and also that I've seen it. And so Ape Escape, not only has it informed the way that I write, probably not, it's also informed the horrible mindscape that I'm forced to inhabit when my subconscious decides it wants to take me for a ride.
I can't handle how scary these monkeys look.
here's the other thing about Ape Escape. It's a hard game. It's like a very difficult video game. So I watched my dad play it and he got frustrated most of the way through because like in order to beat the game, you have to catch like a certain number of monkeys, and he couldn't catch enough monkeys because they're so hard and the environments are so fucking creepy that he got fed up. And I was like, okay, dad, I'm sure it's really hard because I'm a little kid and you're a superhero. And then I got older and I was like, you know what? My dad's just kind of shit at playing video games. So maybe it's not that bad. Father, if you ever listen to this, I love you. And I know that you tried. So I tried to play it when I was in high school. And I was like, you know, okay. You know, I was a high schooler, so I wasn't like phenomenal, but I wasn't like crap. And the second level beat my spirit into the ground.
Oh no.
Like, it's a hard, scary game. And the monkeys are terrifying.
They, like, just looking at images of them, this shit would have given me nightmares.
Yeah.
Their eerie little pentagon eyes with pentagon pupils and their open red mouths.
Here's the thing. I don't remember the monkeys as scary. I remember the monkeys as fine. But yeah, I do remember the pool level was very, very, very frightening to me. But the thing about Ape Escape is that because I played it so early, it is the video game that informs all other video games for me. Like, at some level, I am always comparing games to Ape Escape.
Zora, can you please start a column for SideQuest that compares every video game to Ape Escape?
But only my hazily remembered like version of Ape Escape that does not have quite such horrifying monkeys.
Yeah, I that one that you just Tales of Berseria,
yeah.
I want to hear how Tales of Berseria compares to your memory of Ape Escape.
Unfavorably. It compares unfavorably to Ape Escape. Ape Escape had better politics somehow. Yeah, but I'm not, you know, what I'm saying is insane, but it's also true. Because Ape Escape is I use this actual language in the show notes, is a video game ass video game for me, right? Like, it's from a very specific era of action adventure games, where, you know, there's like some platforming elements, you have tools, and you have to think about how to use your tools on the environments. The gameplay loop is fairly straightforward, right? Like, you go to a hub world, you choose a level on one of these splinter worlds, and then you do the thing that the game does in that world. It's the Mario model. It's the Ape Escape model. That's not the one I'm thinking of. It's the Crash Bandicoot model. It's the Spyro model. You know, it's that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And those games are still being made. Like, I'm looking specifically at Yooka-Laylee from a few years ago, but they don't feel as common anymore. Oh my god, the monkey just reloaded in Slack. Like, it went away and then it came back. but that to me is like the foundational video game experience. It's of loading into a hub world, choosing where you want to go, and then accomplishing something and getting like the brain chemical cha-ching of having completed a task. Mm. And so every other game I'm sort of mapping onto that model, right? Like, I'm playing Control right now. And even though Control is set in the oldest house, and I haven't gotten super far into Control, but like the basic model of control right now is you wander around the oldest house and then you go back to the briefing room or the conference room or whatever where Emily Pope is hanging out. You have a conversation with her and then you go somewhere else and you do tasks in that new area and then you go back and you go out again, right? So that's like the hub world, the level, and you go back to the hub world. So I'm constantly, always comparing everything to Ape Escape. And for me, every iteration on what video games do feel like iterations on Ape Escape. Even though there are things that come from like totally different lineages. But it also means that the games that I enjoy the most have ties back to that formula, because it fundamentally set expectations in my brain. So when I want to like ingest a video game in the easiest way possible, that's kind of what I want to do. And that's why I am the way I am, I guess.
I'm curious, did you play Yooka-Laylee?
I did not play Yooka-Laylee.
Okay, I was wondering if it like, does it, how does it feel?
Here's my thing. I know that I'm so nostalgia poisoned that the Ape Escape I remember is not the Ape Escape that actually exists. And so if I try to play a new game, I will be trying to have an experience that I never actually had. So no new game can possibly like live up to my desires. Whereas if I go back and I play Ape Escape or Spyro, the nostalgia I have for my early experiences of playing them kind of powers me through the friction of the game, the experience of playing a 20-something-year-old game. This is especially fascinating for me with Kingdom Hearts, which is another very early, like, not very early game, but like another foundational game for me. And I played the PS2 version of Kingdom Hearts constantly. But the version I've played more recently is the Kingdom Hearts 1.5 like remix situation, which has a lot of quality of life upgrades.
I am intrigued.
Yeah.
Buddy, it's still a frustrating game.
I did play the very first game, and it was the Tarzan level was a lot.
Oh my god.
I hate Tarzan.
You're gonna hate that level. It does not. At no point does it tell you what you're supposed to be doing. So I have a lot of memories just running around the jungle, being like, "Am I supposed to go here? Am I supposed to go here? Am I supposed to go here? How is this space so small, and I can't find the place I'm supposed to be in?"
Yeah.
But it's just funny because like the new versions of games that iterate on that very specific like gameplay model are never going to live up to the memories I have of experiencing those games when I didn't have control and, you know, Final Fantasy VII Remake, even Kingdom Hearts 2 to compare them to, because trying to reclaim old design philosophies with modern hardware, sometimes that friction caused by the limitations of design from the 90s is like a fundamental part of the experience that can be frustrating, but also inform some of the positive memories you make of those experiences. There's a piece that just went up on Waypoint, just went up like in the last couple weeks, that went up on Waypoint by Too Mellow, who's a composer, where they talk about how these music restorations that are going around of SNES and similarly, you know, compressed limited music, those restorations aren't necessarily, they're not really restorations, quote unquote, to what the music was meant to be. They're remasters, because the music was composed with the knowledge that it was going to be compressed. And so the composers, like, to say that the restorations are the songs as they were meant to be heard is, Mello doesn't say this, but I'm saying it, feels weirdly dismissive of the skill of the original composers, because they knew they were composing with limited data space. And so they composed for that limited data space. Similarly, these games were designed with the knowledge that there were like limitations of the systems. And so when you remaster them, I'm thinking about Spyro here, you can lose some of the interesting choices that the devs had to make because of the constraints of the form at the time. Which isn't to say that Yooka-Laylee sucks. It's just like when I want to experience a game like the games that I experienced when I was a child, I'm just going to go play a game from when I was a child.
Yeah.
Like I can just play Spyro again.
This is always a really interesting conversation to me specifically because, and I wrote about this for us a long time ago, because I missed so much of like quote unquote foundational gaming. And so there was like a big conversation about Shadow of the Colossus in particular, a game I wanted to play when it came out, but that I didn't have access to. And when the remaster came out, there was a lot of like, well, the remaster is like bastardizing what made the original game special. And that kind of thing. When for me, it was I finally got to have the experience that I'd wanted to have as a kid. That I had tried to play. I had tried to play the PS2 version of Shadow of the Colossus long after it came out. But the fact of the matter is, like, in whatever year I tried to play it, because my husband had it and I didn't, it no longer, I guess my patience for shitty controls had evaporated. And so I don't know. I always have this like interest in that kind of conversation just because of like the space that I occupy in gaming. I think my feeling about it is always like these, you know, like the remastered version of Shadow of the Colossus or the way that these music files are being remastered and you hear they're different from one another. It's not necessarily that one is good, one is bad. It's just they're different experiences that stem from like this like one point. And I think that's interesting and I appreciate when we can have a conversation that is like they are fundamentally different experiences. One is not better than the other.
Yeah. No, I totally agree with that. And that's actually the tone that Mello's piece takes as well, is like these things both have value, but to say the issue that Mello was specifically addressing was this idea that this is how the original music was meant to be heard. Which isn't true.
Right.
But the restorations are interesting artwork in their own right. Because hearing the samples in like full fidelity is fascinating and exciting. Yeah. And you can learn a lot from the music that way.
I think constraints like those that many developers of you know, NES, I mean, still today, constraints make for interesting art a lot of the time.
Yeah.
And it is hard, I think, to recapture that same constraint. Like if you're making, you know, say a retro-inspired platformer today, you're having a very different experience than somebody making Super Mario Brothers for the NES. But the constraints are different, and that results in different but still interesting artwork in the same way that like remastering the tracks from the NES or whatever console, like it's still interesting art.
Yeah.
One is not.
I think what's also really interesting is how the constraints differ in like professional, not even AAA, just like medium to large indie to AAA spaces versus very small indie or hobbyist game development. Just because of the resources that are available, right? Like we're getting small indie games that have kind of PS2 level graphics and processing capabilities because those development tools are becoming like casually available. They're becoming more and more accessible to people without studios. And so, but they're being created in, you know, the 2010s, 2020s, which has a which has a completely different relationship to like narrative design than we had in the 90s. And so you're getting these really interesting new combinations of like constraint and technology that I've been really interested in watching come out. And I haven't delved into a lot of it, but whenever somebody talks about like PS2 style games in an indie space these days, my ears perk up because of the different environment in which they're being designed.
Like Paratopic, I think.
Yes. Yeah. I'm thinking of Anodyne. Specifically Paradoxic. Paratopic. Oh boy.
And I think Anodyne as well. I haven't played either, but
yeah, we have a piece on the site about Paratopic, which is legitimately the piece that made that like introduced this question into my mind. This question of like how is development using this level of like graphical fidelity and processing power different than it was so many years ago.
Mm-hmm. It's very cool, and I really like this approach to almost like channeling, like using your nostalgia for the particular visual style in this really new and fresh way. Like it's not it's not using nostalgia in the way that's like remember Ape Escape. It's more like remember how it felt to play Ape Escape, and here is an entirely new take on that feeling of like the almost like imagination space created by like the lower fidelity graphics. Because like when I think about how like a PS, like when I think about, I'm trying to think about a game I played when a PS1 game, like fucking the Rugrats game, that's the only one that's coming to mind. The Rugrats game in my mind looks like the cartoon, but if you look at it does not look like that for a variety of reasons. But I have this like space created in my mind of like what it looked like. And these games that are doing that can kind of tap into that and do really interesting things with my nostalgia for it.
Yeah. This is why I actually have like I have not played the Spyro remasters. Nassim did. Nassim has a very good review on our site, which you can read. So I'm not talking about the games themselves. I'm just talking about my base emotional reaction to them, which is practically revulsion. which feels so mean to all of the people who did so much work to make those games. But Spyro in my head, right? Like, you know, it's like six polygons and hope. the original character designs. But they conjured an image of this world in my head, and the remaster or remake, I don't remember if it was a remaster or a remake.
They call it the Reignited Trilogy.
Okay, well, the Reignited Trilogy doesn't match that image I have in my head. The colors are muddier. The character designs have enhanced the parts of the original that I chose to not focus on as a child. And so it doesn't match this thing in my head. And so when I want to play Spyro, you know, I might play the Reignited Trilogy eventually because it's just more accessible. Because I can buy it on my PS4 rather than having to dig out my PS1. And find my PS1 disc that I still have. but it's not the same thing. It's a different game.
Right. Yeah. It's so interesting. This conversation just always interests me in, like, I don't know. It's just interesting. That's all I have to say about it. Yeah. It's interesting.
No, I would love to see more writing about it. Perhaps even on our website. No, but for real, like, this is something that's constantly fascinating me and clearly all of us. So if we can get more on the site about it, I would love to. I would especially love, like, in my heart of hearts, this is the thing that I want. And it is a comparative analysis of Spider-Man games since forever. Because I think it's Spider-Man 2 for like the PC. One of my best friends has incredibly fond memories of that game and was preaching its virtues to us for years. And then we booted it up once and it was just god awful, unplayable video game. But what I remember of it is that it very much wanted to be the thing that the recent Spider-Man game is. They were just not. they didn't have the resources to make that playable at the time.
That's how I feel a lot about, and Nassim, you mentioned this, was the Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone game.
I fucking love that game.
Yeah, for the PC. Like, that game sucks.
It was so bad.
If you look at it now, every Harry Potter game I've played, I've had a miserable time with, because I played them like 3 to 5 years after release, and at that point, garbage.
Yeah. Like, yeah. It is, like, watching playthroughs of Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone now is fucking hilarious. Like, it is the faces in particular.
Faces were bad.
Just nightmarish. And the gameplay where you have to, like, trace the spell symbols with your mouse is so hard and frustrating. But, oh my god, the experience of playing it was such a fucking thrill however old I was playing it. Just, like... I would be impressed if any other game could capture that feeling of, like, I mean, obviously Harry Potter is extremely fraught in the year of our Lord 2021. But the experience as, you know, a young kid playing, like, getting to explore Hogwarts and cast spells and find Bertie Bott's every flavor beans is, like, fucking Chocolate incomparable.
Frogs. This is also a missed experience for me, because my memories of playing any Harry Potter games was I tried to play it for like 3 or 4 hours, and eventually I was like, nah man, I'm just gonna go play Chia Bounce on Neopets some more. I'm good. Fair. All right.
We need to do a Neopets episode.
I was just about to say that. That was my shit.
I love Neopets.
So good.
Neopets being the gateway to Gaia Online is, I don't think it's a mark in Neopets' favor.
I never did Gaia Online.
That's
I couldn't, neither. I think this is one of those, another generational thing, because all of my friends, my younger friends also were very into Gaia, like role playing on Gaia Online, and I was like role playing on Envision Free forums and Neopets.
I did a lot of avatar art for people on Gaia.
I love this.
That's amazing.
It's like a lot of it.
The most me thing that I can share is that at one point I started a pop punk Neopets guild.
Oh my god,
that's amazing.
It's incredible.
That is the most me fact that exists online. But we should totally talk about Neopets someday, because I love Neopets and it's foundational. Do we have anything else to say about our very cold games?
Icy.
Hit me up at the Ouroboros pool in my dreams if you want an ass kicking.
If you find that image that everybody was sharing around, please share it with us, because I'm so curious.
My poor little 8 gigs of RAM can't handle Google and recording audio at the same time.
Fair.
So I'll look it up in a minute.
Good. So that's going to do it for this episode. Thank you for joining us on this journey into the past, which I think is the hit song from the Don Bluth film Anastasia.
Oh yeah, that's right before St. Petersburg, right? Or right after?
Anyway. Right after, I think.
Anyway.
Yo, I love Anastasia.
Me too.
I don't remember his name, because I don't remember anything about Anastasia, but I do remember that, like, the boy had like very good gender. For me,
Dimitri.
Dimitri?
Yes.
Dimitri had a powerful gender for me.
That is extreme. Dimitri is a foundational character in my memory as far as like my taste.
Great.
Yes.
The earnest, good-hearted con man.
Yeah. Yes. Lovable rogue, one of my favorite tropes.
Oh, this was not my experience. I was like, what if I could make my hair do that?
Extremely fair. Yeah. Also. You can find us online with our Anastasia opinions.
Yep.
Not on sidequest.zone. There you can find our game opinions. But we do have other places. We exist other places online. I'm on Twitter at Melissa Brinks. I fucking hate Twitter, as I say every time. You probably won't find me there.
I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Jamsternazzy, which I will be returning to Twitter once my thesis is turned in 3 weeks.
Brave.
Of a countdown. I'm at ZH Gilbert on Twitter, where you can find me losing my goddamn mind about Ni No Kuni 2. You want to know who you play in that video game? The President of the United States.
What? Really?
Yeah. You wanted me to say some more words about it? Because they're horrifying and they only get worse.
I would like you to deliver them to my inbox, Zora.
Okay, I will. Well, you can check my Twitter for my ongoing thoughts about Ni No Kuni. We'll see how far into that video game me and my roommate are playing it together. And yesterday we were like, we might have to cut ourselves off. We might have to stop before we die. Like, for our health.
I would like a comparison between Ni No Kuni 2, Saints Row the Third, whichever one it is you play the president, and Ape Escape.
I'd read it.
I wonder if we kidnap the president in Ape Escape, because you definitely have to deal with a kidnapped president in Sonic Adventure 2 Battle. And also probably normal Sonic Adventure 2, but I played Battle.
Oh my god, I love it. All the president's games.
It's like a thing in Japanese games. Like, why does the president be showing up?
You definitely, I think the president in Resident Evil, like president of the U.S. in Resident Evil 6 gets turned into a zombie at the beginning, I think. So. Yeah.
Is there anything else we want to plug coming up? Anybody got any cool stuff?
I mean, join our Discord as always. I live blogged most of Tales of Berseria. That game's a wild ride. I'm playing Tales of Abyss. I'm just going to run down all of my JRPGs that I'm playing, I guess. I'm playing Tales of Abyss now, privately, because that game's actually good. And also I'm halfway through it, so it wouldn't make any sense. But eventually, when I start Vesperia, I'm going to live blog the whole thing, start to finish. So that's going to be good.
Hell yeah. Cool. In our last episode, I mentioned that Fakey Girls was doing an episode on Hades, and we did, in fact, do that. It is out. I am happy with it. Please never ask me any question about Hades again. I've talked so much about Hades. I'm incapable of having another opinion on Hades.
That's good. That hold that close. Cherish the quality.
Anything you want to plug, Nassim?
No, I will be getting my copy of Persona 5 Strikers soon, which I will do my usual unboxing video/pictures. So I'll put that or send that for someone to put on our Twitter.
Perfect.
So, yeah.
Excellent. Follow our Twitter too. We're at SideQuestZone.
Oh yeah, that's important. Go to the website, SideQuest.zone.
Yeah.
Read stuff.
It's great. It's a good website, in my opinion. My completely unbiased opinion. So that's it for this episode. Thank you to Alexander Nakarada for the use of our theme music, Base Thee, under a Creative Commons Zero license. That's pretty cool of you to make music and put it under a Creative Commons Zero license. You're the real one, Alexander Nakarada. And that's it. Please go take a nap. I beg of you. And myself.
Oh wait, actually let me tweak my tripod situation a little bit so it's less.
That's fine.
Whoop. Okay.
The recording has started, so at least I don't have to do health checks so again.
They got me making that boop noise.
Yes. Yes, that's very important. Hey, honey, do you need attention right now? You had all fucking morning.
Yes.
Come sit in my 50 skirts. Okay. I will begin. I read your intro already and I like it. So this time I'm not like going in with no preparation.
Did I write an intro?
Yeah.
Holy shit.
I liked it.